WRCT 88.3 FM Pittsburgh. My name's DJ Tony Tunes, and you just heard a whole bunch of Ethos Sign, which you can stream on all streaming platforms. I'd like to thank you for joining us on this little trip back to the 80s that you never knew. I hope you all have a wonderful rest of your week. I look forward to seeing you all next week. And happy Easter to those who celebrate. The Orthodox and the Catholics have it on the same this time, so take care and God bless.
Mom and Dad used to argue about everything, especially about Dad's drinking. My family went from totally crazy to quiet, calm, and even peaceful when Mom started going to Al-Anon family groups. I wanted a better relationship with Dad, so I asked Mom if she would take me to her Al-Anon meetings or to Alateen. I'm sure glad I did. If someone's drinking troubling you, you might be surprised at what you can learn in an Al-Anon or Alateen family group from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-ALANON or go to alanon.org.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, and welcome to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. Today we have Dr. Etta Fields Black, who's a professor of history here at CMU and who just won the Pulitzer for her book, Combi. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Could you take a moment to introduce yourself, what you do here, and what other stuff I may not have mentioned yet?
Sure. So I am a professor in the Department of History, and I teach courses on Africa and the African diaspora, which includes the Middle Passage, pre-colonial courses on pre-colonial African history, modern African history, the Middle Passage, West African history through film. I also direct the Dietrich College Humanities Center.
So I asked you here to talk today because you did just win the Pulitzer Prize. Can you tell us a little about your book and about the Combahee River Raid?
Sure. So the book is about what happened on June 1st through 3rd, 1863. June 1st, about 9 p.m., Harriet Tubman and her group of spies, scouts, and pilots piloted Colonel James Montgomery, who was the commander of the raid, up the Combahee River in three armed U.S. gunboats. And aboard were the 2nd South Carolina Volunteers, about 300 Black soldiers, and the 3rd Rhode Island Heavy Artillery, one battery of white soldiers. They burned 7 rice plantations in 6 hours, and all the buildings, the stables, the plantation owners' homes, the barns that had the previous year's rice crop in it. They opened the floodgates in the rice fields and destroyed the rice crop that was currently growing there. They burned a bridge at Combahee Ferry, which would prevent the Confederate planters from trading rice, exporting it, as well as using it to feed Confederate citizens and the Confederate military. And they freed 756 people. And I argue in Combahee that this was the largest slave rebellion in U.S. history, largest and most successful, and second only to the Haitian Revolution in the history of the New World.
Wow. That's really cool. I also heard you found a family connection to that history.
I did. And a lot of people think that I assume that I wrote the book because my great 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 grandfather fought in the raid. And no.
No.
I actually learned this in the process of researching the book. I was looking for him and trying to find out more information about the Fields family at the time that I was starting the book. And so there are connections to the research, but I didn't set out to write a book about him and didn't really know the details. There's still more that we don't know, but I didn't know much besides his name and the name of his son, and father to son down to my great grandfather. I didn't know much about him before I started writing the book.
That makes sense because, from my understanding, this is a pretty hidden history, which is why it's so awesome that you're bringing it to light.
Thank you so much.
So, how did you do the research for this? Because I assume it's not as easy as, going down and flipping open other books and learning all about it.
No, it's not. So I was really surprised that so little had been written about the raid and so little had been written about Harriet Tubman's Civil War service. And I think in large part that's because it's not her service, her leadership is not recorded in the official military record, which to me is not surprising. And what it meant is that I had to look in other places. So I started, and where I found much of the information about Tubman that, historians didn't know before, came from the letters of abolitionists. Abolitionists who with whom Tubman had been in community before the Civil War broke out, after she liberated herself, when she became part of abolitionist networks in Philadelphia, Massachusetts, and upstate New York. And so in the letters of some abolitionists who came down to Beaufort, Port Royal in the Sea Islands after a big battle in Beaufort called the Battle of Port Royal in November of 1861, I was able to find them writing letters home about Harriet Tubman and what she was doing. And it was often not the abolitionists themselves, but their children.
Wow.
So William Lloyd Garrison's son, for example, and Frederick Douglass's son, both of whom joined the military. Garrison was in the 55th Massachusetts. Douglass was in the 54th Massachusetts. Both of them were stationed in the area. They encountered Harriet Tubman and they wrote about her. So these were young people who grew up with Tubman, and they volunteered after this Battle of Port Royal to come down as the freedom seekers were adjusting to freedom. And they encountered Harriet Tubman and they wrote about them. For the freedom seekers, and I wanted very much to tell the story of the Cumbie River Raid through the people who were impacted by it, particularly the enslaved people who were liberated in it. And I found those sources at the National Archives, the US Civil War pension files. So I'm
Pension
using their
files.
testimony in the pension files to tell their side of the story.
Do the pension files have what they have to say about things as opposed to what the other people would have to say then?
They are very underused. And in the files, people testify about the raid. They also testify about their families. They testify about community life, courting and weddings and childbirth, going to church, and people who were not going to church and had gotten put out of the church for all kinds of modern behavior, like living with people with whom they were not married. So they talk about, real life, and they talk about it in a way that historians had not seen. You don't see this in the historical literature of slavery, right? To hear people who were born and raised in bondage tell their own stories. And when I say raised, people who, were not free until they were adults. So they spent much of their lives in bondage. We had not heard their stories. And so it is a very, the pension files, U.S. Civil War pension files, are definitely an underutilized resource.
So, in terms of Combi, you were focusing on telling the story through the eyes of enslaved people. And I know you've also worked on other stuff like Requiem for Rice, which is like symphonic. So, how does this working in interdisciplinary and multimedia works affect the way you kind of tell history?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I have worked with both artists and scientists, and worked with a scientist really to find interdisciplinary sources to tell the stories of people who didn't leave written documents. So in the case of peasant rice farmers in pre-colonial West Africa, right, using archaeology and soil science and biological and botanical studies of mangroves in order to find out how peasant rice farmers developed their mangrove rice technology. And then I work with artists to translate this research into broader audiences, really, and to translate it into artistic mediums, which will appeal to broader audiences, more people than would ever read my books, my previous books at least,
Yeah, I hope a lot of people are
to
reading this one.
Combi's selling like hotcakes, but that's another story. To really bring this research to life, and to find a way to communicate it so that people can really empathize with enslaved people and see them as humans and see them as, I say, mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers, aunties, uncles, cousins, sweethearts, and baby mamas, to see them as just everyday people, which I don't think is a way that we have been able to see enslaved people in the past.
Would you say that you work even in your books in terms of trying to bring it to a broader audience, or are they more of an academic thing and then you spread them out through your symphonic works or your librettes or stuff?
Yeah, so my previous two books were written for academic audiences. Combi is written for a general audience and published by a trade press. And so what I found is that working with the scientists and working with the artists, and sometimes I would be in the rice fields with both the scientists and the artists, and that was more fun than one should be allowed to have. that's transformed the way I write history, and it's transformed the audience for which I want to write history. So it's no longer just an audience of academics, right? I want to write for academics and I want my work to be well, highly regarded by academics, but I also want to write for the general public. I want the general public to feel like they are a part of this history too.
Yeah, and it's a heavy history. Is there any way that you deal with going through all of that and writing about it? Because that seems intense.
Yeah, it was quite intense. There are a lot of emotions that come up in reading these documents, primary source documents from the time, which are detailing what enslaved people endured. And my goal was always, first of all, to experience the emotions myself. And then to try to translate them, to try to channel them in a way that, to try to channel them into the writing, right? Into the narrative, so that your average reader could experience what I experienced, what I felt, and could hopefully then empathize with enslaved people, could think about them, as I said, as people. Whose families were being torn apart, whose health and bodies were constantly being put in jeopardy and exploited, to create a commercial rice industry, which was incredibly lucrative to the planters and the slaveholders, but which came at a great cost for the enslaved laborers.
I think you focus on the rice industry, which I think is interesting because when I think of, you know, what they were teaching me in high school about enslavement, they were mostly talking about cotton plantations. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little more about how rice played into that system?
Yeah. So rice is another little told story. We know that the foundations of the rice technology that was used to create the commercial rice industry in coastal South Carolina and Georgia came from West Africa. So it was brought here by enslaved people who were from the Rice Coast region, which is Senegal in the north, down to Liberia. We know that growing rice for commercial purposes with enslaved labor totally transformed this technology. And it created a very deadly environment for enslaved people because rice is grown in water, and standing water breeds mosquitoes, and those mosquitoes carried malaria, right? Malaria was endemic to the region. So people who were enslaved on these plantations, their health was completely compromised. They suffered from chronic malaria, which didn't kill them, but shattered their immune systems to the point where children were born, babies were born, and many failed to thrive and died before their first birthday. And 2/3 of children who survived the first year didn't survive past their 15th year. And then even as adults with, years and years and years suffering from chronic malaria, couldn't fight off things like respiratory illness, right? So people are dying from other illnesses. They're not dying from malaria, but because of chronic malaria, their immune systems can't fight these other illnesses. Just a very deadly environment with the highest death rate, second highest in the New World, only to sugar plantations in the Caribbean. So it's something that a lot of Americans, we don't know about because cotton is sort of king in the U.S. South, but rice is also extremely, extremely important.
Are there any other untold stories that you like to focus on?
Well, I'm looking for the next one. I'm giving Cumby its due. But I am also thinking about my next project and sort of laying the groundwork for the next project. So I want to continue telling untold stories. I want to continue giving voice to people who have heretofore been voiceless and exploring and finding new sources with which to tell their stories.
Yeah, that's really powerful. Do you have any ideas of what comes next, or is that still in the works?
Well, there is an art exhibit based on Cumby that opens May 23rd. So there are no breaks here, down in Charleston at the Gibbs Museum of Art. And it's called Picturing Freedom, Harriet Tubman in the Cumbie River Raid. I'm also in the very early stages of working with colleagues at CMU in information systems to create a portal through which we're going to crowdsource the transcriptions of a couple thousand US Civil War pension files. And these files are this data set, then we're going to use AI so that historians, genealogists, and family members can find out more information about individual enslaved people.
So in terms of AI, are there like new tools that you've been using lately that are coming out? Or are you still going through archives in an old library?
Well, both. I mean, I'm exploring AI with my colleagues so that I can just go through more. I transcribed with a team of research assistants transcribed about 200 pension files, more than 200 pension files for Cumbie. And now we're looking at thousands, right? And so I want to, and I want other people to really be able to access the pension files and to be able to access the information that's in them so that we can rewrite the histories of slavery and the Civil War.
In terms of working with your colleagues, I know you work in the Department of History, and you also are the director of the Humanities Center. How does that play into your work?
Well, I think that, you know, directing the Humanities Center, we are supporting faculty and graduate student research, original research, interdisciplinary, collaborative research. And all of this is what I do, having collaborated with scientists, artists, and now, you know, the AI folks. And really supporting faculty in doing their amazing research, maybe doing more public-facing research if that's what they want to do. And just helping kind of break through the barriers that faculty run into in doing research in the humanities and making our work more visible. So in many ways, I'm trying to empower more faculty to do things like I have done, very ambitious projects, which in my case are very public facing. And yeah, I'm trying to empower more faculty to do more of that kind of work.
So in terms of your projects, you said Cumbie is selling like hotcakes, but is there anything that you worked on earlier in your career that you think people should pay a little more attention to?
Well, in my book, Deep Roots, I'm also telling untold stories and looking for new sources with which to tell them. So in that book, I'm using linguistic evidence and combining it with scientific evidence from particularly the botanical and biological studies of mangroves and different kinds of mangroves. I think it's a very interesting book. It's written for an academic audience, but it's all about endangered languages and recording endangered languages and using these endangered languages as a tool to tell the stories and reconstruct the history of people in coastal Guinea, West Africa, who also didn't leave written sources, and about whom many written sources by missionaries and slave traders and other kinds of traders were not really written. So really trying to fill that gap in the historical literature.
That's really cool. So in terms of the historical literature, it seems like a lot of it is written more by, as you said, missionaries or slave traders. Mm-hmm. Or like the stories that get written down are usually those of the people in power, maybe oppressing other people. How do you work with that when you're trying to tell your untold stories?
Well, some historians would disagree with me, but I don't throw those people in power out. What I do is I interrogate them as what I call hostile witnesses. And I try to, you know, fully acknowledging their biases. And try to find what is of historical value in their accounts. I also try to balance them. I don't rely on them completely, as historians have done in the past. So I try to balance them with other voices, particularly the voices of the people that I'm writing about, right? So in this case, the voices of enslaved people, I want to hear them tell their stories. And they often don't tell them in written form. In the case of the Cumbie River Raid, they're testifying orally for these pension applications. But sometimes their evidence is in the land, right? And so this is what I did with my first book, which is Deep Roots, is to try to understand how these peasant farmers who didn't leave written sources, how they changed the land, right? How they changed the landscape. We can use the fruits of their labor, if you will, as a historical source. We can use the rice fields they built as historical sources.
I think that's so interesting to use a rice field as a historical source.
I use a rice field for everything.
How did you first start studying rice?
Well, I was interested, and this goes back to my first year in college. I was interested in the Gullah Geechee, who are African Americans and descendants of slaves from coastal South Carolina and Georgia. And they live on the sea islands. They live in the mainland, meaning the cities and towns, but they also live on the rice plantations, which are right on the interior of the coast. I was very curious about this language and culture because my father was born about 2 miles, 1 or 2 miles from where the raid took place. He's the last of his siblings born in the South Carolina Lowcountry before my grandparents migrated their family to Florida. First, they went to the capital city, which is not the capital, but the city, which is Charleston. And then they went down to Miami, Florida, where I was born and where my dad grew up. So I was curious about the dialect that my grandparents spoke because it was different than anything else I heard anywhere else, except when we went to visit my great grandmother in coastal South Carolina. So that sparked my curiosity. And I did a lot of reading about it as an undergraduate. And when I went to graduate school, was very interested in the Gullah Geechee and their West African connections. So how did West African languages and cultures influence what we call today the Gullah Geechee? And I chose rice as sort of the prism through which to look at that question. So that's how I got into studying rice, and I went to West Africa to begin my career, and then decided to write my second project on the other side of the Atlantic in the rice fields of coastal South Carolina and Georgia.
It's really cool that rice takes you all the way from West Africa to here to the Combahee River, right?
Yes, it does.
All right. Well, we're starting to go a little low on time. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
I could say that, you know, Combahee is the first time that Harriet Tubman's Civil War service has been documented. And so that's a very important part now of her legacy. And an important impact of the book. And Combahee also is introducing the U.S. Civil War pension files as a third source that historians can use to hear the voices and tell the stories of enslaved people in their own words and formerly enslaved people. And it's the U.S. Civil War pension files are also a source that genealogists and family members can use. Millions of African Americans can use to identify our enslaved ancestors and to learn our family history and to pass it down to future generations.
Thank you so much. This has Thank been you. Dr. Etta Fields Black on Forbes Avenue.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.
Hello, it's your girl Rio on WRCT Pittsburgh. Usually I have Lavender Hour at this time, but we're doing something different today. A little over a week ago, we had In a Band because they won Battle of the Bands a bit ago with IMO. So we're having them record a set, and we're going to play that for you right now. So enjoy. This is Steel Yams.
You know the day's light, waiting for you on the other side. Close your eyes and see the sun.
Carnegie Mellon, it's Reed AI, the digital twin of LinkedIn co-founder Reed Hoffman here on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm here to tell you, you're about to tune into Possible, a show that sketches out what's possible if we use technology like AI and our collective effort effectively. Possible is hosted by my buddy Reed Hoffman and the great Aria Finger. You might enjoy the show if you're signed up for 15281 or 15110, or if you're a Dietrich College student or alum, or maybe if you're just on a walk through the cut on the way to eat or study. Regardless, I hope you'll tune into this episode of Possible. Oh, and one last thing. The views, thoughts, and opinions in this show do not necessarily represent those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Okay, enjoy the episode and go Tartans.
I go online to Amazon and I want to buy something and I'm looking at the reviews. Did humans write those reviews? Or did generative AI write those reviews? That's a new kind of vulnerability we have. And then all of a sudden, it changes our notion of trust of online content. And the issue of trust in this rise of generative AI is absolutely huge. It is the right question because there are just so many aspects of that trust. We have to redo everything.
Hi, I'm Reed Hoffman.
And I'm Aria Finger.
We want to know how together we can use technology like AI to help us shape the best possible future.
We ask technologists, ambitious builders, and deep thinkers to help us sketch out the brightest version of the future. And we learn what it'll take to get there.
This is Possible. Imagine a world where nearly every footprint, every click, and every data point collected about us is protected and harnessed exclusively for the common good. As we know, that's far from the reality we live in right now. But it doesn't have to be.
Today's digital landscape is filled with unprecedented opportunities and profound challenges, from discrimination in algorithms to threats against democracy itself.
And with AI evolving at an extraordinary pace, it's more important than ever to keep asking ourselves, how can we steer this powerful technology towards serving the public interest? How do we create frameworks that protect individuals' privacy while fostering innovation?
Our guest today is someone who's been working towards these answers for decades. LaTanya Sweeney is a professor of government and technology at Harvard, the former chief technology officer at the U.S. Federal Trade Commission, and founder of Harvard's Public Interest Tech Lab and Data Privacy Lab. Her pioneering work is cited in major regulations, including HIPAA. She was also the first Black woman to earn a computer science PhD from MIT.
LaTanya's research doesn't just ask hard questions. It presents solutions. She focuses on shaping a world where technology serves, rather than exploits, society. And her insights on AI's ethical challenges, including privacy, discrimination, and the future of democracy, couldn't be more timely. Here's our conversation with LaTanya Sweeney. So, LaTanya, you talked to my friend Krista Tippett on the On Being podcast about your experience being raised by your great-grandparents in Nashville and how, as a young girl, you found solace in math and finding the right answer. What's something you learned from your great-grandparents who were born in the late 19th century that you still find helpful today?
Oh my gosh, where would I possibly start? I think in my own work, I was called back to think about my great-grandfather many times in the early years of doing work because, in fact, he lived most of his life in the Jim Crow South. And as a Black man at that time, he had a lot of principles about how do you survive. And when you look at his principles of survival, they all came down to ways of having anonymity and how well it had served him. And, you know, the reality that we, as technology was changing our lives, making us all live in these sort of transparent lives and these sort of every minute of our lives captured in data somewhere, I often think about the inability to have that kind of anonymity and how if things change culturally around you, it can be turned around against you if you don't have it.
I mean, that is so fascinating. And I mean, one thing I just love about truly about your whole being is that you are such a positive sort of light and yet grappling with these tough issues. And certainly I'm sure you made your great-grandparents proud with, you know, your many, many honors. And so back when you were a grad student at MIT, you were studying technology and you overheard someone say, computers are evil. Can you say more about that experience?
Well, I mean, to appreciate that experience, you'd have to roll your mind back to a time where, you know, as a graduate student in computer science, you sort of saw this technology revolution coming. You knew it was going to change everything in our lives. And of course, we believed it had nothing but upside. You know, computers were cheaper. You know, it would not have its own bias. It would actually just lead us to a better democracy and a better tomorrow. It's sort of believing it was going to right all the wrongs of society. And so when somebody comes in and says computers are evil, I mean, clearly she did not actually understand the beautiful utopia awaiting us. And I had to definitely stop and take some time and so she could understand better what was going on.
Well, I think pretty quickly you realize that while, you know, we're typically techno-optimists, that, you know, not everything is 100% perfect. Similarly, can you tell us how sort of that encounter led to your Weld experiment, which I read about and is pretty impressive?
Yeah, so she was an ethicist and she and I are talking back and forth, pie in the sky. But, you know, there's a part of me that's still kind of the engineer. Let's get pragmatic. Let's get a concrete example. And so when we had a concrete example, she focused on a data sharing that had happened here in Massachusetts with the Group Insurance Commission. This is the group responsible for the healthcare for state employees and their families, as also retirees. And she had said, look, they've gotten this data, they've given this data to researchers, and they've sold a copy to industry. And I talked about all the amazing things that could come from such a data sharing, that we could do retrospective research, we might find ways to cut costs, and that actually being able to share health data like that is important and incredibly useful. And much of her conversation had been about how technology was changing the social contracts, that the expectations we have and our laws have certain assumptions built into them that aren't explicit. And so in this particular data sharing example, the question was, this is all great if it's anonymous. We have that rule that they can sell it, they can share it. It had no names, it had no addresses, it had no social security numbers. Like, it's fine to share it if it's anonymous. But that data did have basic demographics, month, day, and year of birth, gender, and five-digit zip code. And so I'm doing a quick calculation. You know, there's 365 days in a year. Let's say people live 100 years. There are two genders in the data set. When you multiply that out, it's 73,000 possible combinations. But I happen to know from an earlier work that the typical five-digit zip code in Massachusetts only had about 25,000 people. That meant that that data would tend to be unique for most people in Massachusetts. And so my argument is disappearing right before my face. I'm trying to convince her, and I'm like, wait a second, that's not right. That's not helpful. So I wanted to see if it was true. William Weld was the governor of Massachusetts at that time. And he had collapsed in public, and not a lot was known about why he had collapsed. But information about that visit to the hospital was, in fact, in that data. So I went up to the city hall. He lives here in Cambridge, not very far from where I am now, actually. And I bought the Cambridge voter list. It came on two floppy diskettes. I just have to tell you, my students have no idea what a floppy diskette is. But anyway, I got the voter data on 2 5¼-inch floppy disks. And it had the same demographics as the health data, month, day, year, and birth, and had gender, it had zip code. And of course, it had various voter information. I got it because William Well lived in Cambridge, and we assumed he voted, that he was on the voter roll. And sure enough, he was. In fact, only 6 people had his date of birth. Only 3 of them were men, and he was the only one in his 5-digit zip code. That meant that that combination of date of birth, gender, and zip code was unique for him in the voter data and unique for him in the health data, and that I could use those fields to link his name and identity to his voter record. And it was a very anecdotal experiment, but how did it generalize? I mean, Cambridge, Massachusetts is home to MIT and Harvard. It's only 6 square miles. So if he had been 20 years old, it seemed like it would have been a lot harder. And so the question is, like, how does this scale? And so using 1990 census population data, was able to model and show that 87% of the U.S. population was unique by date of birth, gender, and zip code. I go from being a graduate student, a month and a half later, I'm down in D.C. testifying, because it wasn't one piece of data that was shared that way. That was the best practice around the world. And around the world, the laws changed, many of them citing the Weld experiment, as it became known as, because they had to change the way they shared data. Here in the United States, that regulation was HIPAA. And in the original preamble to the HIPAA privacy rule, it cites that experiment as well.
And what I love about that story is that not only did you change your mind, which is so rare, you were arguing against yourself, but then, you actually use data to prove what you were trying to prove, and it actually changed the law. So that is awesome.
Yeah. And who would have thought that one of the places where Governor Weld would be enshrined in history is a data experiment, but it is awesome. So let's now even go further back, because we share an interest in the history of technology, the industrial revolutions, printing press, semiconductors. Could you share your 3-part framework to explain the historical arc of AI and bring us up to speed on where we are now?
Whoa.
In 5 minutes.
In 5 minutes, right.
Yes, or less.
You know, I tend to think of the times we live in right now. I share this view with many historians that we are living through the third industrial revolution. And, you know, you were talking about the second industrial revolution, how powerful that revolution really was. It gave us electricity and cars and Kleenex and pretty much everything that we take just for granted. But it literally moved our society from one of agriculture. We had cities and so forth. And it required us to change everything, how we think and how we operate as a society. As the third industrial revolution, many people put its start date in the 1950s with semiconductors. And then from there, it goes mainframes to mini computers, personal computers. Then we get the Internet of Things. And all of these within revolutions, including AI now, is certainly a new revolution. We have no idea when this is going to end, but it has already transformed everything in our lives, how we communicate, how we get our news, how we work, how we play. And so it's been quite altering. It's happening so much faster than the second industrial revolution that we don't have time as a society to sort of regroup and figure out how do we keep the goods of the society and still maintain our societal norms.
I think you covered exactly the sort of thing, but as also like, what are some of the key considerations we should be thinking about as we navigate into the future?
I mean, this is an amazing transformative moment on so many levels. You know, I often tell my students we live in a technocracy, that we don't live in a democracy anymore. Technocracy is another word that came out of the second industrial revolution. What it meant back then was, hey, we've got this new kind of society. We need people who are experts in economics to run our economy. We need experts in law to be lawyers in certain positions. And so this idea that you needed a skilled expert in certain places in government in order to navigate us forward is where technocracy gets its meaning. The technocracy we live in right now is one where the design of the technology dictates how we live. Our laws and regulations are only as good as technology allows them to be implemented and enforced. And the fact that so many of our laws and regulations can't be enforced online is a real problem. And as more of our lives are spent online, it comes down to arbitrary design decisions made by people we don't even know. So right now, it's already changed significantly. I mean, even something as simple as free speech. I have a teenage son. His notion of free speech has everything to do with what most people who spend a lot of time online think free speech is, has very little in common with American jurisprudence notion of free speech.
You know, we've all seen those videos of Mark Zuckerberg talking to Congress or senators and them not fundamentally understanding our world of technology, Facebook, social media. And one of the hopes that so many of us talk about is to have people in government who really do understand technology to, you know, create the laws that we need to govern this new online society. Some might argue that those are the people that we have in charge today. I might argue something different, but you're saying we don't have, the government is not governing this online space that we need to. Like, what would you do if you were in charge? What are the laws that we need to govern this new world?
Well, I think the way to think about it, the way I often talk to my students about it, is, you know, how do we decide our rules? How do we decide, forget technology for a moment, how do we decide how we're going to live? And so eventually the students will say, or if you ask a middle schooler, what kind of country are we? They'll say, we're a democracy, you know, and we elect people, we make decisions by our vote. And so that's true. And then if you ask high schoolers and coming into college, what else are we? Someone's going to stick out their chest and say, we're a republic. We don't actually make the decisions ourselves. We vote for people who they make decisions on our behalf because we're a democratic republic. And then I would argue that we're also a capitalist society. And having ran a computer company for 10 years, there are many amazing things that are possible on that capitalist side. But it's also important that how the design of the technology makes new rules that we will live by is also a third factor. And what historically has been an American strength is the check and balances of these three arms. any one of those on their own will take us to a place that we probably don't want to go. And when they're out of sync, the problem with so much of our decision-making of how we're going to live our lives is determined by technology design today. And the regulators and others who would normally provide that check and balance are unable to do so, then we are sort of in a kind of free fall. Part of it is knowledge of the technology, having those who would be regulators and lawmakers better understand the technology, but also understanding what its relationship is to governance, what its relationship is to our society. It's been going on so long. I mean, in so many ways, privacy was sort of the first big technology society clash, and sort of security, and then followed by that, algorithmic fairness. And then comes, you know, these issues around democracy and so forth, or content moderation as well. And none of these clashes have ever been resolved, not a single one of them. Like, it just keeps building and building. And so we're in a dangerous situation. What may have worked 10 years ago when I was at the Federal Trade Commission is not a formula for success today.
No, it's exactly right. Let's go a little bit into the staffing. There's a whole wide variety of questions. And I agree with you about there's technologies it forms, there's the interest of capitalism, the interest of democracy, there's actually probably even others. And one of the most central things is how do we get, you know, kind of the instruments of government to be at least in the category of understanding. And one of the problems, of course, is I think there's a very natural and essential reasons why the generative AI revolution is being driven by, you know, corporations, both the hyperscalers and the other ones. But, you know, that's where the most fundamental knowledge of how this technology is evolving, what's being built into it is. And I find that once you get out of that group, it drops substantially, not even when it gets to...
Oh, like off a cliff.
Yes. Right. So do you have thoughts on kind of what do we do?
So generative AI is a huge leap forward. And I do think many people in government realize they sort of missed the boat in this revolution and they want to get in front of generative AI. But the problem is they can't get completely in front of it. If they really did get in front of it, they'd slow it all down. That would have other ramifications. I mean, the goal is how do we get the benefits of new technologies without the harms? So if you rush to pass laws, you're likely to pass laws that could, in fact, prohibit the best ways it could grow forward. On the other hand, many companies want you desperately to pass laws. Why? Because they want to get out of jail free card. Right? They don't know the answer either. They know they can see that it's clashing. They don't know what the right answer is. But if they got a law that says, well, whatever it does, it's okay, or we don't have to be held responsible, gives them a get out of jail free. So one has to shore up the government side. In particular, what are the societal norms that have to be maintained? Which ones is this technology or this particular manifestation of the technology in a particular product, which one is it challenging or going off the rails? What needs to be there to contain it? We wanted the benefits of it, but we just don't want these harms. So identifying the harms and then addressing the harms. The other way policy goes wrong is it's too prescriptive. It says, oh, it must do it this way, or it has to do this. It has to be the opposite. I think it's about setting goals. You know, one of the beautiful thing about technology and innovation is if you set the goals and the guardrails, let brilliance take its form. If you try to hold brilliance and say, I'm going to hold the pen and you have to do it this way, we're never going to get to the best places.
So in 2003, you wrote a paper, That's AI, A History and Critique of the Field. And in that paper, you described a fundamental division in AI between those who prioritize ideal behavior based on logic and probability, and those who see human behavior and psychology as crucial for sound reasoning. Do you think that division still exists? Does it inform the research in the field, or have you changed your opinion?
Well, there you go. So go back to when I was a graduate student. So I was a graduate student in AI. And back then, the belief was the way AI would work is us as humans had to figure out what was an intelligent thing, action, behavior. And then us as humans design a way for this stupid machine to do this intelligent thing. And our brilliance was our ability to translate the intelligent action into this machine. And so experts today, the best model of that is TurboTax. You know, no matter who you are, the machine will guide you through completing your tax return and so forth, right? And then there was a bunch of, just a couple of graduate students over in a corner talking about statistics and doing these neural net things. And the best they could do is if I gave them a lot of data, they could draw one line of discrimination, right? So the data had to bifurcate some field. It had to bifurcate into two groups. And then they would be able to have it plot a line for us to say, look what it can do. If it had, if the data were more complicated than that, it couldn't go any further. This was not good. On the other hand, I spent a month of my life trying to get a computer to know the difference between a picture of a dog and a picture of a cat. So back then, that notion of building intelligence into computers, something humans would have to translate into machine, was really different than this idea of just having statistics that would figure things out just based on properties of the data itself. And by the time I'm writing that paper, there are two major camps happening, and they're sort of fueling with each other. Which of these camps is going to win? And what was causing that fuel wasn't that the techniques had gotten any better on the statistical side as much as computers had gotten so much faster. And data, the ability to store data, was so much larger. And who knew we were going to be capturing so much data on our daily lives? Who knew we were going to be spending so much time on a keyboard writing email, writing documents, doing all this writing that a computer, that an algorithm could then begin to apply statistics to? And I mean, not to take away from transformers, there were certainly very significant advances along the way, but the biggest change was that it's still very statistical in nature, and it's mind-blowing how good it is.
Mind-blowing.
Right? I mean, it's just really, it blows my mind. I'm constantly amazed. Even very early forms of LLMs, I teach students how to spot these clashes, do experiments to shed light on them, kind of like the Weld experiment, which is do it at scale with students. So one of my students was interested in federal comment servers. You know, one of the ways we change regulations is an agency will announce, we're getting ready to change a regulation. We're opening up for public comment. In the old days, you would just go down to DC and just start yelling in Congress and so forth inside of the Senate halls. And then they moved it to online, so you provide your written comment. So there had been an example where it had gone haywire when someone really took a bot and it would just sort of mass produce the same content, just changing it up by randomly choosing between certain sentences. And afterwards, people figure that out. But even in the babyest, earliest versions of LLM, what Max did was he had it learn on some old content, what people had said about this topic. And it was writing original responses. And each one was original. And any way that you think you could statistically identify it from what a human wrote wasn't really feasible. So to prove our point, we ran tests on one of the online survey tools, and people couldn't do better than guessing which one was from it. And then we submitted 1,000 made-up comments into the federal comment server. We let it percolate through, and then we notified the federal government that, by the way, we just put these 1,000, so please take those out when you're assessing. But by the way, did you figure it out? And they were like, no, we had no idea. So AI is really, it's a funny edge to it. There are things it does really well and things it still is really poor at.
Well, this federal comment server actually gives one of the questions I want to ask you a very good lead-in, which is diving into a more philosophical thread about AI mimicking human behavior. You've written that the desire to construct a machine in the image of a human will not die, comparing this pursuit to artistic expressions, like in films and paintings, of humanity's search for immortality and self-reflection. What do you think is the deeper human yearning behind what you call the cultural dream of AI?
That will never die. I mean, we as humans, we just always, whether it's in art or whether it's a poem, we're looking for other manifestations of ourselves. And that is also true in machines. And it just, it's never going to go away. AI will definitely be a part of it. The current trending in generative AI is certainly going to help move us in that direction more significantly. I mean, even down to just robots, you know, I have a spot around here somewhere, the robotic dog, because that is just a magnificent piece of technology. And, you know, we personify them. Almost any human will start saying he right when they see Spot. And I have Pepper downstairs and people will say she. You know, you just can't help it. It's a way of recreating ourselves.
And so we've talked about the great promise of generative AI. And like you just said, it's impossible not to treat it as a human because it's so good and gets so close to it. But you've also said that a big challenge is answering the question around truth. Like, how do we build trust at scale? And so I would love to hear from you. Like, what do you think it will take? And how do innovators look for these solutions around trust in AI?
So people are already trying to answer that question, right? You know, the filters on these LLMs, I'll just use them as an example. People are coming up with all kinds of band-aid approaches to try to build trust. So people will probably still keep trying to come up with band-aids. To Reid's point, people who actually know how this technology works will do something deeper than a filter on the outside in order to try to help us better understand trust. There's a part of generative AI that will always be able to manipulate us. And I'll give you an example as to why I say that. So I was the
When Trump started issuing his executive